Hello everybody, welcome to another episode of the Envision podcast. My name is Karthik and I am your host for today's episode. On this podcast, we bring together people who have had a positive impact on the blind and visually impaired community from across the world and share those stories with you. Today, on our podcast, we have Sandeep. Sandeep is a stand-up comedian from India and is also partially blind. He's here to talk to us today about being funny, about stand-up comedy, and about growing up blind in India and how assistive technology has helped him cope with his illnesses over the years. So without further ado, welcome Sandeep. Thank you for joining us on the podcast today.
Hi Karthik, thanks for having me on the podcast. It's a pleasure joining you today.
So Sandeep, you know, when we start these podcasts, we usually start off with the origin story, right? So can you tell me your origin story? Where did your story, you know, began?
Do you want the medical one or do you want the one which the church gave me? I have two stories. I think the church one is a little dirty. Let's keep it clean today. So I was diagnosed with a condition back in 1990 called macular degeneration. It basically got defined as Stargardt's disease more recently, but the first year was a lot of testing and uncertainty because the doctors back then were not really familiar with too many kids my age who have eye conditions that were this severe. So they really didn't know what it was and what caused it and what could lead, you know, what it could lead to. So they did brain scans because they thought maybe a sort of viral in a sort of brain fever, which has caused this sort of vision loss. They did a bunch of blood tests, then sort of went to a bunch of eye doctors who did, like, you know, these glaucoma, all these various things where they poke you, they jab you, they kind of dilate your eyes, and then they put you through these sessions of hell. And then you're like, you know what, can I just, you know, I think the eye condition is much better than what you guys are putting me through. So that was almost a year of it. Then landed up actually at this hospital, which of course you're familiar with. It's from your hometown, Shankar Netralaya. And there I met the founder, Dr. Badrinath, who's he's a truly remarkable man. And I, you know, as a kid, that fear, and for my mom as well, the uncertainty of what this, what's the future for a person with this condition is. So for her, it was, okay, what's in store, right? Will he go completely blind? What are the things we need to take? What steps, what preparation, what are the possibilities? What is the future going to look for someone with this condition? And for me, just as a child going, dude, what the hell is happening? I've been poked and pricked by older men. Okay, that sounds really wrong, but it was doctors. But it was that kind of meeting with Dr. Badrinath, who said, this is the condition, it's called macular degeneration. We're not really sure if it's Stargardt's disease or cone rod dystrophy, but there's one thing which I can guarantee you that based on this, you'll never go completely blind. That's what he told my mom, your son will never go completely blind. He said, young man, you won't be able to see really well. That's something you have to take in your stride and make peace with, but you will never go completely dark in your eyes. And, you know, just be happy, be positive. I think I'm obviously paraphrasing. This is not what I didn't write it down back then. But he gave me some sense of, you know, some sense of comfort. And I think some sense of closure for my mom with, okay, this is it. You know, this is what it is. We can start working from here as opposed to, oh shit, what's going on?
Yeah. And I think, you know, how old were you when this happened, right? I'm just trying to picture how old were you?
I was between 8 and 9. So I was in my third grade, third standard. And I, yeah, I remember the fear of... It wasn't like the fear of a medical diagnosis for me the first day, because I fortunately don't remember being able to see, but I remember this day in class where I'm looking at the blackboard. Is that okay in today's culture to say blackboard in the woke culture, or should I say the board where they write on?
I think blackboard is something that all of us sort of, you know, yeah, have grown up with, like, at least folks from India know.
Yeah, then I won't get cancelled, yeah. Right? For saying blackboard.
Yeah.
So I was looking at it and suddenly just everything went blurred. So when people ask me, what does it feel like? It's like, I think the closest thing I can come to is when, you know, sometimes you are in the shower and soap gets into your eyes and the entire thing just goes completely blurred. It's for me, it just went blurred and remained that state for the past 28 years. But it's so interesting what the brain does. Yeah. The brain kind of compensates for it. So it's created this kind of sense of empty space is not really a blind spot or a blurred spot, but it's kind of almost the brain tries to compensate and fill up that place with something. So it's been an interesting game, which the brain and my eyes have been playing with me.
Yeah, you know, and the thing is, you're the first person who is on the podcast actually from India. And a lot of people who I spoke to from, you know, Western countries often say that, you know, there was a support system that the society had given them apart from their family. But I know, yeah, growing up in India, you know, and being from India and interacting with a lot of Indian folks from the blind visually impaired community, that it is often not the case in India that you also get a fair amount of societal support. How did that have an impact on your life growing up? You know, because you were 8 years old, you were just trying to figure out things with. And yeah, like I'm sure you had your fair share of challenges, you know, growing up in India with this particular kind of disability, right?
Well, let me start off by saying I had a tremendous amount of support from the family when it comes to access to people living in Europe and America. So we could get second opinions, we could get access to magnifiers or literature on low vision. But when it comes to a support system outside the family, in the schooling system, or generally when it comes to an outlook towards disability, it was very, very early days and very, very, how do you put it? Very, I wouldn't say regressive or primitive, but it was not there. It was, so the thing is, when back then, when I was growing up, a disability was seen as a bad thing, which was crippling, which made you, which confined you to a sort of special home with a special school, you know, strap you on with special gear, make you look. So it was more physical, more developmental, mental developmental issues. So it was, you know, that was the kind of perception of disability. So the moment someone would hear it, they would think that, oh God, this kid has got some major issues where they can't function as a member of society. They need special care. They have to be, you know, in a wheelchair with a nurse looking after them. They'll be, you know, and to this extent where they thought that people, that this kid's going to be drooling and acting weird, going to be violent. So sadly, that was, you know, it while there are people with disabilities who need attention like that, the spectrum is so wide that now the conversation has sort of reached a place where people are like, okay, you know, we don't have to have this kind of this brushstroke, which puts all of them under the same kind of needs and the spectrum of what the requirements and assistance is. But back then there was that fear that if I get labeled as a disabled person, and this is of course in retrospect, I didn't really think this much when I was 9. If I did, I wouldn't be here. I'd probably be doing something more like wouldn't be a comedian, you know. But yeah, what's nice is that I can look back and say, okay, you know, because my family kind of gave me this push and gave me this sense of support, I didn't have to worry too much. But yes, the biggest challenge back then was hide your disability and try and not stand out. Be as normal as you can and don't try to get the wrong kind of attention, because, you know, then you will be kind of typecast as a disabled person and then your roles will be limited in society. So the advantage was that I was able to study in a normal, so-called normal school with normal students with a certain amount of number of provisions given for me. But it became very sort of kind of understood that I'll just function within this. But, you know, a classmate would read out from the board, or, you know, I would have to squint and read normal font. But then the large font came into my sort of exam papers, which were magnified and, you know, sort of zoomed and printed, came in a little later. I would be given additional time for exams. But then my mom would sort of step in, and she was the role that the disability office would play. Like, she did everything from transcribing my notes, reading out my textbooks, recording all my books on tape so I could listen back to it, because the first few years she would read it again and again and again. And then her levels of frustration went up. I said, you know, just for a peace at home, I think it's better you record it so I can at least rewind and forward. This is when cassettes were around. So not MP3s or CDs. And so she literally single-handedly was the disability infrastructure for me. And then in sort of the high school system, it got, you know, it got a little magnified with the teenage side of issues, the adolescent problems along with the disability that created a sense of other worldly problems when, you know, you magnify the mood swings with the hormonal hormones raging in your body and the eye condition. And then, yeah, that's probably going to take another entire series of a podcast.
But really interesting. And you kind of, you know, was comedy at that point, you know, anywhere on your radar? Was that, I don't know, was that something that you turned to when things got a little messy, so to speak, in life? Or did that come much, much later in your life? I'm not really sure at what point did comedy actually enter.
Mm-hmm. But I'd say comedy, you know, there was no defined career as a comedian, especially. I mean, there, you know, in India, we have the regional languages that have their own kind of version of comedy, whether it's mimicry or this thing. But I never even gave it thought, you know. I mean, I definitely did love watching, you know, episodes of Mr. Bean in the 90s, or, you know, there would be obviously Laurel and Hardy and Charlie Chaplin, but never really thought of me being a spoken word artist where I would entertain people through jokes. But while that did happen in comedy, sort of was something I looked at in 2010 as a part-time profession, then got into it full-time in 2012. I think subconsciously I would use it as a defense mechanism to sort of diffuse situations and awkwardness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, you know, because when I was listening to your comedy, it is very distinct from the ones that I see from a lot of Indian comedians, that, you know, there is, you know, there's not
funny, right?
Yeah, it is. Yes. Yes, it is funny, because, yeah, no, there are folks who do get labeled as comedians, but not exactly funny. But then, yeah, in your case, it was definitely funny, but the material was also very different from the stuff that I usually see with other comedians. And before even jumping into that, I think, you know, I did, you know, hear a few podcasts, and I did read that, you know, you did have a different career in IT and copywriting before you actually jumped into comedy, right? How was that? Like, you know, you finished your college, did you just go into IT and copywriting as you know it, as we know it is today? Or how did that journey start? Because, you know, I think that was, you know, was there some pivotal moment in that journey which sort of led you on into comedy itself?
Well, just to sort of first thing first, when you say a career in it, I really didn't, wouldn't call it a career, because a career probably comes with some sense promotion, or some sense of fulfillment, or maybe most importantly, some sense of future in it. So I had none of it, because I graduated from the US. I went to a liberal arts college, got my degree. How, I don't know, but I did manage a degree in sociology. And so then it was sort of this thing, what do I want to do? And, you know, I wasn't sort of desperate to stay on in America. So I did one sort of option for me back then was to get into the space of rehabilitation counseling for people with disabilities. I'd had a glimpse of what it meant and involved when I had done my internship a few years back. So 2006 December, I graduated, but in the summer of 2005, I had done an internship with the KCI Institute, which is a part of the Oregon Health Sciences University. So through that, through that internship, I worked a little bit with the Oregon School for the Blind, with the Low Vision Rehabilitation Clinic. So it gave me the sense of, you know, I'd like to work with people who are either, you know, more visually challenged or in a different bracket when it comes to age group. Because for people who lose vision at a later age, it's so many more years of independence taken away. So I thought maybe I can help in that transition from using assistive tech, or maybe depending more on people, because that's a big first step to take, saying I can't do it myself. So that was one sort of option I considered. But then I realized I have to do a master's in rehabilitation counseling. Then I said, I have no chance. Am I going to study more? So then I came back to India in 2007. I don't know why I'm saying 20,000, but 2007. And kind of this space where, you know, parents are like, what are you going to do now? You've graduated from the US, a bunch of money spent, really haven't got good grades. And what's the future like? I mean, they were chill about it, but they wanted me to do something besides just sleep in the whole day and go partying at night. So then a friend had started this agency, an ad agency, And I sort of went in as an intern, you know, never really thought I'd be in advertising, but he said, you have a flair for words and you like writing and it's fun. You can do a bunch of things and experiment with what you might like and what you might end up doing. So I started scripting a little for copy, for ad copy. Then I started scripting a little bit for radio jingles. And there was a character, which would be this sort of cities reflection character, which would talk about the things that were happening locally, current affairs, politics. And I would kind of help script that. Then the that was for about 8-9 months, and then I realized the money's crap. I was spending more to get to the office and back than they were paying me, and literally like in the auto rickshaw was I think 3 times the amount they were paying me. And then my mom's friend, our parents' friend, who runs this IT company, said, why don't you consider asking him to move here? We can experiment with what roles he might be interested in. So it wasn't it while it was a technology and IT sort of services company, I had nothing to do with that except the fact that I worked in a marketing capacity, like between the user experience and marketing team for content requirements. So I would help with editing, or you know, if there's some web content. I don't know how that even happened, because my spellings are atrocious. I'm not, imagine this, right? They thought like, we need someone to go through the content and make sure that the content that appears to the client is really well put together, proofread, and also spellings are correct. What do? Let's get a guy who can't see and has horrible spellings. That was the job description, and that's how I got it. So yeah, I would help, you know, like this internal, literally it was across the spectrum, from content for the website to editing technical papers, which was a disaster because you need to know a little bit of technology to edit those papers, to the other extreme of my job role, which was, can you write a tagline for TGI Fridays at the office, which is free samosas and cups of tea? So that was my copy as well. So really, it wasn't the most fulfilling thing, but it was, you know, paid a monthly salary. I got to sort of have my own beer money without asking my parents. Like, I've come back from college, can you spot me for some cash to go drink? So in that regard, it gave me some sense of independence. But it also gave me a chance to start exploring stand-up on the side, because 2009 is when we had our first open mic in Bangalore. And I got on stage and I was like, okay, cool. This is something which I can really enjoy doing. Not, I don't know if as a professional, but I can get on stage on weekends and vent my frustration about the crappy work week and the people I come across who really annoy me. So that became an outlet, and did that for 2 years as an outlet on the side. And simultaneously started getting on stage more often, started a few comedy nights in Bangalore with a friend of mine. So we went from just one or two open mics that a Bombay comedian called Veer Das brought down, to starting our own comedy property, our own comedy club, sort of a traveling comedy club, and then got into a sort of past the audition at the Comedy Store, which was a club in Bombay back then, which is a sort of British club that opened up in Bangalore. And next thing you know, it's 2012, January, and I'm like, you know what, I'm done. I'm going to do this full time.
And you know, when you were working at the gig, at the IT company, was it also maybe one of your first exposures to, you know, assistive technology in the workplace? Or, you know, were you exposed to assistive tech at an early stage? Because I know personally that you're someone who's also quite tech savvy. So I was just wondering, when did sort of technology also sort of flow into your life at that point?
You know, actually, that was 2008, right? So the weird thing was, I've been exposed to tech in various forms. It was, say, a handheld magnifier, a sheet magnifier, because every time I'd go to Shankar Netralaya or an LV Prasad or any place, or even a clinic and thing, they were always, I would always go to the low vision rehabilitation center where they would have all these devices, you know. But I was exposed to a screen reader very, I would say before even I left from India, because in 1998, 1999, or maybe it was 2000, I went to the Enable India office. Enable India is this NGO, which is doing tremendous work to sort of help people prepare, help disabled people across the board, equip themselves to get a job and give them various sort of tools that they need. So back then it was very small. In fact, the co-founder Shanti Raghavan sort of sat me down and said, there's a thing called JAWS. it's called Job Access with Script, if I'm not mistaken. And she said, we're going to, I'm going to teach you touch typing, and you can use Windows. You can use Microsoft Word. It'll give you a sense. And I was like, wow, man, this is really sort of something, right? So then I realized computers is the way forward for me. But when I went to the UK, before I went to the US, I was in the University of Wales for a while. Mm-hmm. And they gave me a laptop with from the disability office. So this is when I realized, oh, there is an office for disability, which was the first exposure to a university system which had accessibility, more importantly, accessible tools. So they gave me a laptop with JAWS. Then I had to return it when I went to the US. But I'll be very honest with you, the first year I was a little cheap. I didn't buy the software, so I'd use the pirated one. And it would only play for 30 minutes before shutting down. And
we all have, you know, like, I think all of us, start off with the pirated versions, unfortunately. And then,
Here's the irony, right? I would spend $300, $400 on a weekend going out in Portland, Oregon. But then I'd be like, it's so expensive to buy the licensed JAWS version. Like, absolutely no priority on what is important. But anyhow, so that was my exposure to tech and assistive tech, and things got better. You know, I moved back, and I think when 2000, that class with touch typing and introduction to JAWS was a life-changing moment. The next big one for me was getting my first iPhone in 2010. So I got the iPhone 4S, and I was like, whoa, wait a second. I can read SMS. I can type out messages. I can text people, send email on the go, and I can do also. And that also kind of was one of the reasons I was like, you know, I can actually do stand up as a career, because I can take inquiries on the phone, send emails, create a profile. I can put posters up. I can access social media. It just really made, it opened up a lot more avenues. So then I'm like, you know, why should I do a desk job and do something? Because people are like, you know what? It's comfortable. He'll get paid. He's out of the way. He's not really going to cause any trouble. At least he's at an office, accountable for something from 9 to 5. He's, not a total write-off, but he can at least, you know, figure out some kind of schedule or routine, which would be decent for him. There is always, don't create too much of a nuisance for anyone. Don't really be self-harming, but at the same time, don't stand out and take too many risks, because you might hurt yourself or annoy people. But I was like, you know what, I'm done with this. And this is not just, you know, there's not family or any one person, but that was general sentiment, right? Don't stand out too much. Try being as normal as you can. And then I was like, you know, F this. And I said, I'm going to do stand up. And I think technology in many ways gave me the strength to realize that I can do something different and I can do something I enjoy. And the technology aspect took away one, I took away one uncertainty away, one less. So I had one less uncertainty in my life.
Yeah, and I can definitely imagine, you know, like today being a comedian or any of the Gen Z professions, a TikToker and all that stuff kind of seems within reach. But I can imagine, like, I don't know, 10 years ago, being a comedian is something, it was very, very offbeat, especially in a country like India, right?
And yeah, back then, if you went to TikToker, you'll just be hanging off a pendulum. That's pretty much the extent we could achieve. Get your granddad's clock in the drawing room and just hang off that. That's the thing, Karthik. It's given a lot of choice to people. While they don't have to do Insta stories or TikTok or Snapchat, I think it's given that power of choice to create a YouTube channel. And it's amazing. I think that's the biggest word I would focus on is choice.
Yeah, I think that's really definitely the case. And because I want to know how that journey has been from being, you know, an upstart who would just go to open mics in different places in Bangalore or in Bombay to sort of, you know, making your own space for yourself, right? How has that journey been? And where do you look to inspiration for your material, right? Where do you sort of dig into to come up with things to make jokes about, you know?
You know, the two things about the stand-up, right? One is the disability angle and the second is the career angle. To answer the career angle, I never really sort of had a 5-year plan or a 10-year plan or a path to sort of sort of have these waysides, which are have these benchmarks going, okay, in 1 year I want to do this, in 3 years I want to do this, in 5 years I want to do this. My thing was, the moment I got on stage, I'm like, when's my show at Madison Square Garden? You know, I just had very unrealistic expectations, but never really sort of had a manager. I've never been represented by any agency or management or promoter. I just loved doing shows live on stage. Never really gave too much importance in the early years to the business side of things. I was like, if I can get on stage 5 times a week, I'm the happiest person. And because that was my mindset, maybe I struggled to become famous, or whatever you want to call the byproducts of comedy is. Maybe I didn't get, you know, I don't have a Netflix special now because I didn't really focus on the business thing or play the right template, which was required from a young era, from a early time in my career. But I just truly love performing. And I think as a result, what happened is I got better and better as a comedian because I just love performing. And I'm not the kind of comedian who scripts out my entire sort of set. I don't have my jokes all written down. Having said that, the first couple of years, it was really, really bad, my performance and my comedy, because I really didn't, there was no Indian sort of English stand-up comedian who I could look up to as a mentor. All the reference points were either Chris Rock or Bill Burr or Dave Chappelle or Seinfeld or Rodney Dangerfield or Robin Williams. And you can't really do that here because they've been doing it for much longer, and the audience there also is a lot more different, and they're used to comedy for many more years. So you have to play the Indian comedy angle here. So you have to do the cultural differences and typically stuff which is like, oh, you know, like the husband wife jokes and the political humor. And I was just very sort of robotic first 2 years, and I never, now coming to the second point, which is the first point about my disability, I never addressed it on stage because I was scared. Because for so many years I was told, be normal and don't stand out and try being the best version of fitting in. And now suddenly I'm like, what? I'm expected to talk about, first of all, go make people laugh. They're in fact coming to the room going, what the hell is this thing where a guy literally comes on stage and tries to make us laugh? So there's a bit of a confrontation kind of attitude already. People are going, come on, man, let's see what you can do. And now you want me to add in this element of handicap disability to an audience who was like, I want to hear about sex jokes, you know? So that was my fear. I was like, how are they going to accept me? Will I be rejected? Will I be booed off? Will I start crying? You know, there's so many emotions. And then a friend of mine told me, you know, dude, let me tell you one thing. It's not about doing it for them. It's not about their validation. And this may be with stand-up or in life. You got to understand that this is what you have. You can't get back your eyesight. You have this particular vulnerability or this chink in your armor, and you have to make peace with it. And once you start talking about it, you build a bulletproof version of yourself because you're talking about yourself and making fun of yourself and addressing the parts that you're insecure about. So no one else can hurt you or touch you in that regard. And I started doing it slowly. I started scratching the surface, got a couple of blind jokes here and there going, you know, it's horrible going on blind dates in India because the worst thing is that the entire family comes along and next thing you're in an arranged marriage, some kind of crap joke like that, but it works. It breaks the ice with people. And then till date, people come up to me going, that blind part of your comedy is very funny, but is it true? I'm like, why the fuck make it up, dude? Like, really? Out of all the things, why would I make up partial blindness as a gag to follow? And 10 years later, as I said, you know, I've done everything I wanted to. Regrets or no regrets, I didn't really kick off on YouTube. I've never taken that path too seriously. I believe in finding my audience across the world. It's not about finding Indians across the world. It's about finding everyone who sort of relates and finds my comedy funny. And while, you know, it might take longer than some other people's path in comedy, I don't see myself stopping anytime soon. It's been 10 years and I want to continue doing it. And I particularly believe that, you know, comedy reflects on your life and where you are in your life. And the past 10 years have been great learning. And I hope the next 10 years are even better when it comes to how I view myself in the world and how that is translated through my comedy.
Yeah. And, you know, like you, I was just going to touch up on that because I read somewhere that you've done over 600 shows across India and beyond as well. Right.
Yeah.
And you know, you have those first 10 years and then you have the next 10 years. And I think 2020 is the year that sort of shook things up a lot for everybody, right? So I was just wondering, you know, you've been doing all these live shows and these gigs, and then all of a sudden 2020 happens. And how did that look for you? You know, like when the world started going into more of a lockdown, how did that sort of phase, or what did that phase teach you? And you know, what was going on during that phase, actually?
Well, it was the best thing that happened to me. You know, I hate to say it because a lot of people struggled, but it's the best thing that, very selfishly, best thing that happened to me, because give me a chance to put the brakes, give me a chance to look at why I'm doing comedy. I just, in fact, just before the lockdown on Feb 5th, I'd recorded my special, which, you know, it was the first attempt I made at a scripted, semi-scripted recorded show. So I just put it, recorded it, went into edit, and then the lockdown happened. So then, you know, I sort of put it up on YouTube in May of last year. But the reason why the lockdown was good, as I just said, is because it gave me a chance to take a step back and look at myself in all aspects, not just comedy, not my career alone. I was like, what am I doing this for? Let's say comedy. Okay, I'm worried more about the other things that come along with comedy, worried about what other people think, whether I'm doing enough for marketing, whether I'm on the right social media platform, why I'm not selling enough tickets, am I getting enough tour dates, why am I not getting enough tour dates, is my comedy funny? And you know, while that should have been the first point, is my comedy funny and what do I want to say through my comedy? It was more about the other things, about what, who's doing and who is doing how well and where they're doing. So I started really bothering me, and my anxiety levels for the past few years had been through the roof, and I was sort of drinking too much, and it was getting pretty out of control, to this extremes of like, oh my God, like rage to uncertainty, then extremes of emotion. So this lockdown, which happened in 2020, really just helped me say, you know, screw it all. There's no pressure now to achieve. And if I don't do it tomorrow, nothing's going to happen. It sort of taught me, especially, and I'm sure it taught a lot of people, that, you know, you can only plan for so many things, but nothing is certain. And uncertainty isn't a bad thing. So yeah, it gave me a chance to say, okay, you know, let's figure out. You don't have to rush and run the rat race to be a part of it. You can do things at your own speed, for your reasons, and figure out your stuff in your own time. And the biggest thing is use technology and tools which are there for your own reason, which is to find your audience wherever they may be. So great. And then it gave me a chance to sit down. Yeah, go on.
No, you were saying something.
Right. No, then I sort of I fortunately had a podcast which I was working on called Life Gone Wrong, which sort of got picked up by Spotify. So it gave me a chance to also talk to people who are, you know, have an attitude to life, which is great. So it gave me more and more strength to sort of look at the way I want to live my life and how and why I want to live it like that. So it was a lovely time, you know, not to sound romantic or too philosophical, but it was a great time that it happened for me, because really I was sort of spiraling out of control in all aspects of life.
Yeah, you know, and I think that was sort of segueing into my next question, because you mentioned about it giving you time to pause. And I also think that, you know, this gives you a chance to have a few new beginnings, which is the podcasts that you're working on right now that got picked up by Spotify, right? Can you tell us a little bit about that, and how did that, you know, happen?
Sure. So just to go back a little, 2019 in February, end of February, my radio job, which I was a host on a radio station in Bangalore, got done. So I wanted to explore this world of interviewing people, and more importantly, not interviewing people, have a conversation with them, make it informative, make it funny, make it fun, make it lively, and not gimmicky, full of these talk shows where you have to play a game, or, you know, you have to like, oh my God, it's crazy. You like iguanas? I love iguanas. You know, one of those put on things. And not only about their achievements, going, oh my God, tell me about your latest movie coming out. So, you know, Indians, we love copying, and we also want quick success. And I was like, you know what? I don't want to do anything which sounds like a Tonight Show or a Daily Show. So I did two, three of these rough interview format live shows called Insights with Sandeep Rao, where I would talk to musicians, and I would talk to restaurateurs, I would talk to bartenders. Is there about maybe four in total? And I did it and it didn't really go anywhere. But in the meanwhile, I wrote this concept for a show called Life Gone Wrong. The idea being, everyone has a life that goes wrong in some way. The severity is very personal, and relative, because what might seem insignificant for someone else might be the biggest problem in your life. So it could be a divorce, it could be you bunking, you failing an exam or losing a job, to someone having a child born with autism, or someone losing a parent or losing a child. But one thing which is inevitable is that someone and everyone will experience some form of wrong. And in a society like today, where everyone is sort of flaunting and playing this victim card, where like, look at me, I'm so wronged, I'm offended, I'm insecure, the wrong pronoun offended me, I'm hurt, look at my sensibilities, they really, really sort of, no one cares about me. I want to talk to people who've seen wrong and experienced these kind of situations, from everything, from adversity to disability to any kind of thing, to people working with people to help them. To kind of highlight not the achievement, but the attitude that they live life with. Because many of them have this thing going, yeah, it happens. Can't do anything about it. But let's figure out how to live the rest of our lives and how to live it in the best way we can. And the second most important thing I would say is that I lived the longest time of my life going on these four things, which is blame, shame, guilt, and fear, where I would try to blame people for my situation. I would be ashamed of who I am. I would be afraid of the future and guilty for the things I would do, because as a result, I would be frustrated and lash out at people. And I would also focus and be upset about the things that I lost, about my eye condition, how I can't do things, how I couldn't drive, I couldn't read, I couldn't play sports. But slowly from 2015-16, kind of talking to a couple of people, my therapist, and sort of looking at life differently, I arrived at this place in 2020, which was, I'm going to try and focus on the things I can do. And that's pretty much what life gone wrong is.
Interesting. And, you know, I know that there are quite a few creators in the blind, visually impaired community who are slowly getting into things like into the audio space. You know, I know mm-hmm. there are people who have podcasts. We have our own podcast, and, you know, there's people getting into Clubhouse. And, you know, I wouldn't say advice, because I don't know if that would actually fit the term, but what are some of the lessons that you learned, you know, while working on your podcast and storytelling with voice in general, right? Because I'm sure there's definitely some creators listening to this podcast who might sort of benefit from the lessons that you've sort of learned in your journey working on these podcasts, right?
I think the most important thing is we need to identify here that all disabled people are defined as disabled, but they're very different people. All blind people are not the same. You know what I mean? We just have this common thread of visual impairment, or certain tools that we use, or certain situations that are common. But everyone, especially I'm talking about visually impaired blind here, because many of your listeners might be one of the two. When you're doing a podcast, I think talk about what interests you, talk about what you know, and talk about what you want to share about, what you want other people to hear you talk about. If you're interested in cooking, do that. I don't think the important thing here is that you're blind. Now, if you are visually impaired or blind, I think finding the right kind of tech to do it the most convenient and the most effective way, that is important. But you don't have to flaunt the blind card, because I feel that's too much of that is being done, because I think it undermines you as an individual with all your layers and complexities when you just define yourself by one label. So talk about what interests you, talk about what makes you, what sort of makes you breathe, what makes you angry, what makes you pissed off with the world at large, or whatever interests you. It could be basically who are you? And I think that's the beginning of where your story starts. And, you don't expect, I think, anything to happen overnight. But at the same time, don't lose hope after many nights.
Yeah. No, I think that you put it in a really nice way, that it does take a bit of time and effort to find your own voice, because I think the most obvious thing would be to start off with what you can relate to and then find a voice for yourself over a period of time. And that sort of brings me to the last, part of this whole thing, this conversation. This is a question that I tend to ask all our guests that come in, because everyone has a very different perspective on this, right? Yeah. If there's one thing you'd like to leave, one thought you'd like to leave our like our listeners with, right? What would that be? So, to put it in a more cliched way, I would say, what is your mantra, Sandeep? You know, yeah.
Wow. Okay. I think the most important thing an individual can, and the thing they need to do in their life is understand and appreciate the fact that they their body and their mind is the only thing that they have, and the only thing which you have in this life as a medium. So the sooner you make peace with all its positives and negatives, the sooner you realize that you can live the best life for you. Of course, there are so many social issues, so many socioeconomic filters. There's so many filters, you know, there's so many disadvantages, advantages, so many things, and there's so many layers to break through. But if you are in control or appreciate your mind and body for everything it is and it isn't, I think you are, at least your unit is ready to take on at least something in this life. And yeah, I think that's the only thing you can do, you know.
Yeah, yeah, there is an element of, I don't know, self-reliance to the whole thing. Yeah. Okay, that's really interesting, Sandeep, and thanks for really taking out the time to do this with us today. Really appreciate it, and thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you, Karthik. Thank you, and thank everyone for listening, and everyone at Envision for the work you're doing, because I think it's the beginning of a revolution in the assistive tech space, and I think you guys are at the forefront, so appreciate it, and thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much, Sandeep. Bye.